grab this. Okay. So I'd like to focus our attention on one of the habitats that I've spent a lot of time in this year. Because of COVID, I planned to spend this whole year in Mexico working on a scuba dive project, but you know, everybody's plans shifted.
Oh yeah, I can imagine. This is quite a shift.
So scuba diving shut down, and we came back to California kind of in an emergency, and they ended up finding a place with some friends in Mariposa. And which is how I came to spend a lot of time in the Merced River Canyon.
Oh, okay. So you're above Comanche.
Yes.
Above the reservoir.
Above the reservoir. That's right. Yeah. Kind of. So it's really kept me sane. And my best memories this year are all between Yosemite Valley and the Railroad Flat campground. So this, you know, this stretch of the Merced River runs between the high mountain snowpacks that feed the waterway and the dams that retain water for agriculture in the Central Valley.
Sure.
And I spent a lot of time wondering about this part of the river and what it might have looked historically. There are many alike tributaries in this section that run from the Sierra Nevadas to the Central Valley. And I was wondering if you could start by maybe outlining what you think are the most significant changes to this part of California's streams and rivers and how the historical ecosystems compare.
Well, you know, one of the first things that always comes to mind is once you got dams on the system, they are dividing up the habitat and denying access to the anadromous fish that used to go up there.
Yes.
I'm not as familiar with the Merced as I am some of the other rivers like the Tuolumne, but you know, the Tuolumne, we know that the salmon went up a long way up into the system. And I assume the same was true for the Merced. So when you cut off those big runs of salmon and steelhead, you're changing a major source of energy for the system. And so just that alone makes a major difference. Plus then I noticed you've been seeing smallmouth bass in those systems. The introduction of these non-native species has also made a big difference to the systems. And it's not just the fish. It's, you know, all the crayfish you see are not native, for example.
Really?
They're major components of those ecosystems. So even the outside of flows and things like that, just a few of these changes that resulting from non-native species and so forth have made the system so they're, as I said in that paper I sent you, these are novel ecosystems with species from all over the world getting, you know, interacting with each other. And that includes the riparian vegetation too. You know, a lot of the plants you see in the riparian zone, a lot of the forbs, the grasses are not native, and a lot of the trees even are not native, fig trees and so forth. So you just a lot of subtle changes to the landscape that look as you, I know you notice you talk about the shifting baselines. Well, one of the things we're used to seeing these systems the way they are, but they must have looked quite different in the past. Different set of trees, different set of shrubs, and so forth.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. The paper you sent about the nitrogen load that comes from the salmon migration.
And that's something that's not original with us. But what's different about our paper is that we tied into farmland for the first time. But people who study these salmon in the Pacific Northwest and Alaska have recorded some major effects of the salmon nutrients on the forests that these streams flow through. You get bigger trees, for example, where you have a salmon stream.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, how we could reconstruct those changes like to the flora would have been just from that loss of nutrients.
Well, you know, the problem with California is that it was settled so fast But, you know, there were a few naturalists here in the 16th and 17th centuries, but basically once the gold rush started, California became transformed almost overnight, and everybody here was so looking so much for gold, another resource to exploit, they didn't even bother to record what they were seeing, except for a very few people, what kind of changes they were seeing on the landscape. So, in other words, a lot of guesswork is involved.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the things they found in the Pacific Northwest is that where you have some really big old trees, that they could relate the width of the tree rings with the number of salmon coming into the river. So by looking at that relationship in recent times, they were able to go back 500, 600 years and get some idea from tree rings of how big the salmon runs. And I don't know if there are any trees in the foothill zone that would have that kind of record or live that long, because cottonwoods are a relatively short-lived tree, I think. Maybe some of the oaks might look that way.
I can think of one or two trees that, just because of their position on the river, they found stable. But yeah, they found a spot to stay, and sure, just from the width of the trunk and the gnarl of the root ball, they look like they might be, you know, a hundred years old at least.
Sure.
But most of the trees do look quite young. They're ash trees with trunks like less than maybe 12 inches in diameter.
Yeah, and of course the gold rush was 150 years ago, so
yeah. But even that wouldn't get us old. And most of the oak trees are further up the canyon, so you know. Though I guess, like you wrote, you know, that those nutrients aren't limited to the stream bed, because they get distributed through the ecosystem by scavengers and consumers of the salmon.
Yeah, well, it surprised us when we did that study of how many different kinds of animals were using the salmon, even deer coming down to browse on them.
Really?
We get some of the photographs we took with our trail cameras show deer coming down and munching on the salmon. So getting nutrients, obviously, probably calcium from salmon carcasses. You just don't think of these cute little deer eating and being carnivores.
Well, we have plenty of deer here, actually, where we're at in a pretty remote area. It's actually not hard for me to imagine them. You know,
they
get by with whatever they, you know, there's, I think that's one of the things my stepfather's always told, he's a biologist as well. He's always told me is that the only rule in biology is that there's always an exception. So you can't.
Yeah. Learn. Yeah.
So this year you mentioned the smallmouth bass. We've seen those in most of the spots that we swim.
Sure.
We've also found two populations of pike minnows in deeper pools.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen the suckers, I'm not sure which ones, they're really difficult.
The Sacramento suckers, almost certainly. Although I should be careful, because in the rivers like the McCollumy, there are some of the, some artificial connections that have been made in the upper headwaters to the Eastern Sierras. So you have Lahontan red sides and Tahoe suckers making your way down into the upper reaches of those streams.
That's cool.
So you gotta be careful. Whatever you see, don't take it for granted, you know.
Yeah. And I'm not actually taking samples. I'm just shooting video.
Sure.
So sometimes it can be hard to do the species level.
Incidentally, one thing I wanted to mention, since you're interested in the Merced, is to look at the smallmouth bass closely. Because in the Cosumnes River, which is sort of a watershed over,
yes.
There's, well, actually you have the Stanislaus and the Tuolumne in between. But at any rate, the Cosumnes is totally dominated by red-eyed bass. They've eliminated all the native fish.
Really?
And the red-eyed bass is a very beautiful little fish, unfortunately. It doesn't get much bigger than 6 inches, but it's very aggressive. So if I don't know if you, any of these bass you've been snorkeling, they have come up to you and looked you over.
Oh, they're very much so.
Or are they super shy?
No, they're not shy at all. They're quite curious.
Because the red-eyed bass are remarkable for their, if you're snorkeling in a stream, they come right up to your mask and look you in the eye.
How can you distinguish between the two?
Well, the red-eyed bass is darker. It's well-marked fish, and it has white on the edges of its fins. It's like a brook trout. The leading edges of the pectoral fins, pectoral and pelvic fins, have a white.
I'll review the.
So it's very noticeable, actually, and their body color is sort of greenish with sort of bars on the side. They're very colorful. So you might notice it if smallmouth bass can be colored too. They can have red eyes, although they don't always, just like red eye bass don't always have red eyes. But when you notice it, especially if you did a lot of snorkeling in streams with bass around, the first thing I noticed when we were working on the Cosumnes was just how in your face they were.
Yeah. Well, either it's a shared trait or they are indeed red eyes, because I would 100% agree with that. Like it's been really fun to take video of them because they're super easy to get close to. They just swim up to you.
Well, if you could send me a section of that video or a still that shows what the fish look like, I could tell you.
Well, yeah.
I'm actually very curious to see if, because I think red-eyed bass are underreported. Most people don't recognize that they're around, and they're a real threat to the native fish.
I'll send you a lot. I have a lot of ticks, so I'll send you a reel.
Okay.
So we've also seen rainbow trout. They came through during the spring and then migrating upstream, and then we're not finding them lower river now, but if we go up closer to the valley, we see them in the colder pools up there.
Do you think they're migrating up from one of the reservoirs?
Well, I'll tell you what I observed. I only saw them once during the migration, and it was at a spot downriver, and I didn't even know what they were. I was swimming with some smallmouth bass, and I didn't get a take of them because I didn't have my camera with me, but they swam right by me, and I followed. They caught my eye because they were really beautiful, and I followed them up to the next rapid, and they swam right up the rapid, and then I didn't see any again.
How big were they?
They were small. They were, I would say, like maybe six.
Eight, 10 inches, something like that.
Yeah, somewhere in there.
Yeah. We're probably 2 or 3 years old then, yeah.
So, but I figured out what they were and then managed, and then just asking around, we realized that they were probably staying in the colder pools. So we went looking for them, and we found a pool filled with them.
Yes, and in mixed areas, you tend to see them right where the fast water is coming in, right where there's water dumping into the pools, because they like that, the oxygen there.
Yeah.
And also the bubbles provide cover.
Yeah.
And the food coming right down as well.
And they do, they're skittish. They're very difficult to get close to.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, we haven't seen any steelheads though, or none that looked like that to me though. I'm new.
Well, it's something to always be aware of. Say, how far above the reservoir were you snorkeling? How far above the reservoir are you?
This would be about the first sighting where I saw them during the migration would have been about halfway between the valley and the reservoir, the Yosemite Valley. And then I would say I have GPS coordinates for all the pools if you're really curious, but I would say about 3/4 of the way up the valley, just below the Yosemite Valley, is where they are now.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I know there are lots of trout in Yosemite Valley. They are suckers up there too. I'm just, again, it's one of the things that we're curious about is how many of the big reservoirs have salmon and steelhead populations that are using the reservoir like the ocean.
Oh, wow. I didn't think of that. That's incredible.
Yeah. We have, we found that was, when I was teaching, one of the classes I taught was with a geology professor, it was ecogeomorphology.
Yeah.
And that involved lots of rafting trips down the Tuolumne River.
Awesome.
And we always bring nets and things along to sample the fish. And we started realizing some of the fish we were catching were juvenile salmon. And of course, this is the reach of the Tuolumne, which is above Don Pedro Reservoir, New Don Pedro. And the Department of Fish and Wildlife has been planting salmon in the reservoir for years as a supplementary sport fish, assuming they would never reproduce. But nature has its way, as they say.
Yeah, they will adapt. So I guess the thing to do would be to go to the I actually haven't been to it yet, but the main dam on the Merced, there's three dams on the Merced River. And I think the furthest one upriver, I'm looking now on the map. There's a lake, you know, or a reservoir above the dam. Lake McClure. So I guess the thing.
Oh, Lake McClure, yeah, that's right. Okay.
So the thing to do would be to look for them in Lake McClure. I'm guessing during their. I'm not sure what. When would you expect them there if they were?
Well, if they're typical, these Chinook in the Tuolumne, we saw one of my students went up there actually in the fall in September and October and saw a few adults, small adults. So. In late fall, essentially September, October, in some of the barriers as you get upstream.
Really,
and you know the Tuolumne is a lousy place for salmon because we're talking about water that's below these dams, and so it's below Hetch Hetchy, below Eleanor, Cherry Reservoir, which means that most of the sediment gets captured, so that it's hard for the salmon to find a place where the stones aren't all locked together, so they can actually spawn. But they clearly have done it because we caught the juveniles.
Yeah. So now I'm new to salmonoids, so. Do the trout mature into do rainbow trout mature into steelheads in the ocean, or do they mature and then migrate?
Actually, you know, this is a huge question that everybody loves to talk about. You'll find a huge literature on this on the relationship between salmon and between steelhead and resident trout. But basically, the resident trout that have their, and what this is something that's been discovered in the last couple of years, there's actually a gene complex that determines whether you're going to go to sea or not.
Oh.
And you can actually look genetically for that gene complex. And you can tell whether a fish,
really?
You take a fin clip of its fin, do the genetics on it, you can tell whether that fish will go out to sea or not. Or has a capability of going out to sea, I should say.
And so that will that also will determine whether or not they undergo the like morphological change.
Yeah, that's right. Basically, you know, these juveniles are ready when these fish are ready to go out to sea. They turn silvery.
Yes.
You know, they become smolts. So potentially, they become silvery and start migrating downstream. And that's partly done in relation to the phases of the moon, for example. This has something to do with their hormonal shifts, but they. When they're ready to go, they go for quite quickly. It takes them a few weeks to transform themselves into smolts, but then they go. And if they get intercepted by a reservoir, that's the way, you know, they live there for a few years and go back upstream and spawn again.
Wow. So
we know rainbow trout especially do that. The discovery that salmon do that is much, much more recent.
I see, I see. So I could start with maybe a literature search to see if there were rainbow trout doing that in Lake McClure.
Yeah, I'm not aware of it, but you just have to have some biologist out there looking. You know, be lucky enough to have some fishing game biologist who is interested enough to look at some point. It's like recently, before the drought, this last drought, so I don't know what's happened. Now, there is a biologist at the Sacramento office, the Rancho Cordova office, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, who is snorkeling above the reservoir, Folsom Reservoir.
Right.
And much to his surprise, he'd get beginning reports from fishermen that they were catching salmon above Folsom Reservoir, which, you know, there's two dams between the lower American River and Folsom. So there's no way the salmon getting up there, but he went out there and started sampling and observing and saw that sure enough, there was this run of Chinook salmon coming out of Folsom. And these were tiny fish that were, rather than being getting the large size that Chinook usually do, they were 14 to 18 inches long, which is just amazing. So, you know, miniature salmon essentially coming up.
Wow.
And they both observed them spawning and captured juveniles. So they figured it was an established run. But, you know, the lake dried up during the drought recently, Folsom. So we have no idea if the salmon, if that run has been wiped out or not, or whether it's been reestablished.
Wow. Yeah, that's so interesting. Like totally adapted to anthropogenic pressure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's like kokanee salmon up at Lake Tahoe. I don't know if you've ever been up to the South Lake Tahoe, the Forest Service South Lake Tahoe. Forest, but it's a visitor center where Taylor Creek comes into the lake there. Okay. There are big runs of kokanee salmon that go up there in the fall, usually in October. Hundreds of people come to see these fish, and they're really cute. Yeah, these are the really bright red, so the classic salmon that are bright red with green heads.
Yeah.
And they're 10, 12 inches long or smaller. And they look just like these big adult salmon, only they're miniature. They're
miniature versions.
And they even attract black bears. So it's just funny. If you get up there at the right time, you see thousands of these little baby salmon in the stream. And the bears fishing for them. Just like in the grizzlies and the rivers of Alaska.
Of Alaska, yeah. only in a miniature version. So we've also seen, we've seen a few pools with, or we've seen one pool with the American river otter.
Mm-hmm.
And one small snake. I think it was a Sierra garter snake.
Sure.
Are there any other animals you think, or fish especially, that are notably absent from this particular type of habitat, this sort of upper mountain river habitat?
Well, you know, it depends on who there's been any sampling done. I'm just not aware of that. Although the Merced's a fairly accessible river, so I would think there would be sampling. But the sculpins, these small bottom fish, they would be good to know if they're still there or not. There are several species of minnows that could be there too. The California roach, for example, is a 3 or 4 inch minnow that's endemic to California.
I think my wife may have spotted a sculpin once, but it moved quickly, and I haven't seen any smaller fish like those four that I've described already. Uh-huh. Or the ones I've seen. So if they're there, I mean, you know, I haven't been looking exclusively for small fish, but I feel like if there were a lot of them, I feel confident I would have seen one by now. So if they're there,
for small fish, when you first see them is in the spring after you've had some high flows, and that's when the suckers, for example, are spawning, and they'll produce thousands of young, and they'll be in big, big schools of fish that are, you know, half an inch long or even tinier as larvae along the edges of the stream.
Interesting. Yeah, it's also hard to say, like, you know, I've only got sort of half a year on the river, so I don't have the full sense of the cycle. And I confess, like, I spent the spring, the best runs of spring, I actually spent surfing on the Merced. I hadn't.
Really?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Yeah, some really fun standing waves on that river.
These are standing waves that are where?
There's a few spots north of Briceburg.
Okay.
And they're roadside stops. They've got names and like small local groups of surfers that.
Oh, interesting. I had never heard of people surfing in the freshwater. Those are the kind of things I hear rafters talking about all the time, and kayakers, yeah. But not surfers.
It's a real scene now. There's a community of people here that go every year to ride these standing waves that come from the spring melt.
Oh, interesting. That's a very short season, I would assume.
Especially this year. Last year, I was told, was really good. You know, surfers always like to say how good it was the year that you missed it. And I guess I missed the really good year.
But it sounds very cold, too. That water must be chilly. Well,
it is chilly, but I'm a Californian, and I'm up from Northern California, so I'm not afraid of cold water. You're from Minnesota, right?
Right.
So
no, that was many years ago. Water. Yeah.
You're accustomed now to the warmer, Are you in Davis?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So pretty warm there.
Davis is our closest stream is Pewter Creek, which is a regulated stream and quite warm down.
I read about your work there. Congratulations on that. I hope to visit it one day.
Oh, that's been a good thing. You know, it's one of those things that I got interested not too long after I arrived here, a few years after I arrived here, because it was when my son was seeking adventure. He and his friends would go down to Pewter Creek, and we discovered they were jumping off a bridge into this big pool beneath the bridge. But the pool was entirely maintained by effluent from the UC Davis sewage treatment plant. I said, you know, it's great to have the places these kids can go, but that's, we should try to clean up the creek a bit.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, we've already sort of touched on, I am focusing on the shifting baseline. And one of the main problems we're confronted with when assessing ecosystems is that there are no formal monitoring projects for species before the European expansion or the industrial.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. So we don't often remember what the habitat was like. Now ecologists have found some novel ways of finding this information, pulling records out of unlikely sources. You mentioned the trees, which I definitely got to look that up. I think that's really interesting. Can you think
the best information, there are a few naturalists who took good notes. And that's what, there's a group at Berkeley who's been trying to replicate the trips of, what's the guy's name? Anyway, a very well-known naturalist who was interested in birds.
Really?
And he recorded birds and trees, did a series of transects through the depth down the Sierras. And they're trying to replicate his transects. And finding, and being able to detect some real differences.
Did those naturalists, from that era, were they doing sort of formal surveys where they were taking counts and doing like a transect like we might do today? Yeah. Or
I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the naturalist who was at the Berkeley people are tracking, but around here we have Tracy Storer, was a professor here at Davis for decades back in the 1920s and 30s, and he took, these guys just took notes. They were natural historians. They weren't especially trying to be quantitative, but they took notes on everything they saw, even if it was a common bird, and they often made little sketches of habitat and so forth.
I should probably check John Muir's writings.
Yeah, he had some of that, but he wasn't, some of these guys just went out and did it like a science. They went out really trying to determine. They're interested in the communities, how things are structured. So they're going out and recording everything that was present in areas.
Right.
But there are very few of those. That's the problem.
And there's a new field emerging too, that I'm reading more papers with, of what do they call it? I think historical ecology might be the phrase, or yeah, the idea is they look for records in unlikely places. Like they might find records, you know, in old financial transactions. I think actually in one of your, I think you referenced that in one of your salmon papers where you talk about looking at some of the early commercial catch records for salmon in the San Francisco Bay.
That's based on cannery records.
Cannery records, is it?
Yeah, you figured how many cans you get per salmon, and you have to make some estimate of salmon size and so forth. You can come up, that's where how you can come up with these very rough estimates of large numbers of salmon, because they were just for the sheer volume of cans they were producing, meant it was just a lot of fish. And so you have to make all these assumptions and you come up with a number, and no one else is going to come up with a better number than that. So you're sort of stuck with it. And it makes sense. You know, it makes sense that there were hundreds of thousands of salmon coming up and they're just being shredded by the fishermen.
Right. Would they have been, I guess they would have distributed into the upper tributaries of the main rivers of the Central Valley.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And they went up into all the major rivers. And, you know, this just shows you what the gold rush was like. We know there must have been major runs of salmon up the Yuba River because it's got all the, everything about it is right. The grading is right. There's a lot, aren't any natural barriers to speak of up a long ways up the rivers. Yet there are no records of salmon from the Yuba River from the 19th century. Because the gold rush got up there, they destroyed the environment. The salmon died out very quickly.
Right.
And the mining continued for a long time after that. So right. Yeah, things like that, the baseline literally just got destroyed in a matter of just a handful of years.
Yeah. And it creates a barrier that's difficult to look past.
So you do much better in going to places like the McLeod River, which is on more of the geology doesn't include any important minerals. It's more volcanic. And so you have this river that even today, large reaches of it are fairly natural, although the flows are greatly diminished from what they were historically because of dams.
Right. So you've done work in California for, I think, 40 or 50 years now.
It's 1969 is when I arrived out here, a long time.
So even just your own personal experience, looking back over the course of your career, what have been the most significant changes to the freshwater ecosystems?
Well, it's just this, you know, by the time I got out there, all the big dams had been built, or most of them. So already that big impact on the landscape was there. Mm-hmm. And also coming from Minnesota, I was not really aware of how California worked for quite a number of years and trying to figure out, you know, and how things were. And I was actually looking for a more pristine environment to study. So I tend to do a lot of work on foothill streams that were relatively undisturbed, or I thought they were at the time anyway, or on coastal streams. And didn't necessarily think a lot about the overall approach. I think one of the things that really got me going though was in the 1996 actually, which is quite a ways up there, was the Sierra Nevada Ecosystem Project, which was an attempt to figure out, Forest Service had a mandate to better manage the Sierra Nevada, again, it's related to fires and things. So they organized this project to try to get people and a bunch of scientists together to build a picture of what it was like in the past and what future, what was likely to happen in the future. and it produced this massive report, which has a lot of good stuff in it. But, you know, they produced, everybody produced this report. The Forest Service said thank you and then went about doing things just the way they had before. Right. But there's the documentation of SAMA numbers in the Central Valley came out of that project because they had money to, so I could hire Ron Yoshiyama, who was a postdoc, to work with me. And he was a guy who was just meticulous. He loved going through the literature and finding these anecdotal accounts of where salmon were.
Right.
Which is what makes those accounts so valuable.
That seems to be like sort of the dominant change to the ecosystems from the whole European expansion period.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, you think of the salmon, they were the fuel for the ecosystem in so many ways, everything from plants to birds to fish. And they were wiped out through this combination of terrific overfishing. In the early days, in the 19th century, they were, you could just set your gill nets across the river and catch all the fish, literally catch almost every single salmon. And people just didn't seem to realize what they were doing. And what happened, of course, was that they wiped out the fish in the Sacramento River, then the canneries moved north to the Klamath and the eel. Then after that, they moved north into the Puget Sound.
Right.
So that was the standard American way of looking at these resources. They're inexhaustible until you exhausted them.
Have you exhausted them? Yeah. Yeah. That's certainly not unfortunately, that's not a story that's unique to salmon fisheries. You know, you see that in a lot of marine ecosystems too, and marine fisheries.
And also, even by the time I was here, got in the state, a lot of the areas, the ecosystems, for aquatic ecosystems, were dominated by non-native species. The reservoirs, for example, were pretty much non-native species. And the lowland rivers were pretty much non-native species. So you had to look. I've always had to look hard to find the natives and figure out where they were and what they needed.
Right. It's interesting. It brings me, it comes to mind one of the concepts you talked about in a paper that you sent me, Rosenweg's reconciliation ecology.
Oh, yeah.
Right, which it sort of attempts to reconcile human habitats with wild ones. Can you talk about the difference between reconciliation and restoration, and what are the relative risks and disadvantages?
The restoration ecologists will always deny this, but the term restoration means you're trying to go back to some past condition, something like it was. And you're trying to restore something. Your typical restoration ecologist says, no, that's not what we're trying to do, but it is a methodology of working with native species and trying to bring as many back as possible. And when I talk about reconciliation ecology, it's you're starting with these non-native species are not going to go away. Mm-hmm. So how can we live with them? How can we be reconciled to having natives and non-natives together? How can we manage the environment that keeps these native species going while realizing we are not going to get rid of the non-natives? For our reconciliation ecology, you recognize you'll have communities of non-native and non-native species all interacting with one another, and some of the natives are going to lose from that. And for those, you may have to have special refuges. But it's like in the Delta. Especially in Susan Marsh, where I've done a lot of these long-term studies going on, there are 25 species of native fish and 25 species of non-native fish that are about equally common.
Yeah.
That seem to have worked it out. Some species like the Delta smelter are on the verge of extinction, but that's not due to the non-native species, although they don't help at all. Actually, I should take it back. Because one of the major reasons Delta Smelt is disappearing is the invasion of a non-native clam. But it's not non-native fish that are the problem. So anyway, it's things like that that are that they have to live without. And I mentioned that in part because there's been a big push periodically. You get a big push to get rid of striped bass, for example.
Right.
A non-native species. It's a favorite of anglers. There's a fanatical core of striped bass anglers out there who like it when I appear at hearings because the striped bass is here. We're not going to get rid of it. In fact, right now, not so many of the native species are doing so badly. The best indicator we have, because there's still a lot of them out there, the best indicator we have of the condition of the estuary in terms of its ability to support diverse fish is striped bass.
Right.
Because it uses its entire life history takes place in the estuary. It spawns in freshwater and lives down in San Francisco Bay and so forth. So you got to maintain the whole system if you want striped bass around. And many of the other native fish benefit from managing for striped bass. So that's sort of an example of reconciliation.
And how the native fish benefit just because you're fostering a healthy ecosystem?
Yeah, basically the striped bass, for example, feeds on plankton when it's small. And it needs a fairly rich system and it produces good plankton populations. Those are the same, the smelt need those same kind of resources.
Right.
You need appropriate inflows going from the river into the estuary. Because striped bass, when they spawn, they're basically larvae, the young fish, are washed downstream, and the timing is such they go up just far enough upstream so that when their eggs are as their eggs hatch, as they're slowly bounce along the bottom as they move downstream, and the larvae pop out of the eggs just as they reach Susan Bay, which is the place you want to be if you're a baby striped bass, because that's where the most food is. So it's almost as if they evolved here. But what it meant, of course, is that it was a lucky introduction in that they found just the perfect conditions for the striped bass.
That's why they were successful moving into the habitat.
Or you take the American shad, which has similar requirements as the striped bass in terms of needing clean stream. It spawns on the tributary streams like the Yuba. It needs clean water in the spring, and it needs enough high enough flows so the young can get out into the estuary. Right. And that fish has been so successful, especially during the gold rush era. It was designed for these streams that were so sediment laden. It's now colonized rivers all the way up to the Kamchatka Peninsula in Russia.
Wow. So
it's one of the common fish in the Pacific Ocean.
Wow. And then back to the striped bass, like the anglers, you said it's a very popular fish with anglers. So
yeah.
You know, I noticed that you seem popular with the sport fishing crowd with a lot of glowing interviews online.
Sure. Well, that's because I've been working over the years to protect streams and manage streams, find ways to manage streams. And that generally fishermen who want, especially those who are interested in fly fishing and interested in catching salmonids, recognize that you got to protect the streams.
Right.
If you want to have the fishery. And I've always treated the steelhead and the salmon as another native fish. And the advantage I've always had is being an academic, I could take the 500 foot or 5,000 foot view of things.
Right.
Because the typical fishing game biologists are always involved in, they're in regions and they're always involved in their regional or local problems, and they have a hard time seeing the big picture.
Yeah. It sounds like you've also played a role in promoting catch and release fishing.
Oh yeah, that was sort of funny. It's one of those things I did not realize what I was getting involved in. But yeah, when I was working doing some of the early work I did when I came to California came to Davis anyway, was working on the McLeod River, which when the Nature Conservancy acquired or was given 6 miles of the river to manage, and they said, "What do we do that?" This is one of the things that people don't realize. The Nature Conservancy is now this massive conservation organization. Back in the mid-1970s, it was made up of a bunch of local chapters.
Right.
And the Northern California chapter of the Nature Conservancy suddenly had 6 miles of this amazing river donated to them by a fishing club. Because the owners were realizing that they couldn't afford to keep, they either have to give their land away or cut all the trees down.
Right.
And they decided that they would rather try to maintain the forest. So I guess I was on the board of the Northern California chapter at that time, and they asked me if I would like to be involved. And I said, there's nothing I would want more. Well, the result was that, you know, it's a superb trout fishing stream. Which we documented, and we also just showed that catch and release fishing was the best way to manage it, because Nature Conservancy at that time, the people were very conservative who were in charge of it. They thought fishing was inappropriate, as a matter of fact.
Right.
For a nature preserve, you know, why would you abuse these poor fish who you're trying to protect?
Right.
And I had to convince them, first off, no matter what they did, there could be fishing down there. You could make it either legal or illegal, but there wasn't going to be fishing. It was just too good a stream.
Right.
And then once I convinced the Nature Conservancy of that, and I could work with the California Trout and other organizations to try to figure out how you can get catch and release regulations on the McLeod, and that was new. There were only one or two streams in the Western U.S. that were catch and release at that time.
Right.
And that meant, you know, of course, I had some very enthusiastic people I was working with there, the Caltrout people, Dick May in particular, who was the head of Caltrout, who founded it, were just, you know, they were salesmen. They really wanted to catch and release fishing. If I could provide a biological justification for it, they could go ahead and literally lobby for it, which they did, of course.
That's awesome.
They're the kind of people who the Fish and Game Commission, which is made up mostly of duck hunters and fish meat fishermen, it's the kind of thing they could not say no to.
Right. Opening up another opportunity for fishing, but one that was, it is kind of a reconciliation as well, right? Between
sure.
competing pressures.
That's right. And you had to, I looked at it as that was a system that was already heavily modified because McLeod Dam upstream diverted about 80% of the water. And then it flows into Shasta Reservoir. So you have this stretch in between of just superb trout water. It's very cold because it's spring fed.
Right.
But it was not like it used to be. You know, it was a very different system than it was historically.
You write about encouraging desirable species through management. How do we decide what are desirable species?
Well, it changes with time. Yeah, actually, like the striped bass, a classic example, is introduced as something everybody wanted. Then it became regarded as sort of a villain in terms of eating all the salmon and so forth. And that still hangs into it. And now that's turning around again because of the idea that it's a highly desirable sport fish, and it's a good indicator species for the estuary. So yeah, it's a matter of societal attitudes.
Right. What about?
And I tend to think of it as what species are good for the system. Right. You know, what species interact? Like the red-eyed bass, for example, is an example of a species that's not that very desirable. It's a beautiful little fish, but it just mows down the native fish. In the Dominguez River, we study that there are no native fish wherever you find red-eyed bass. That's all you find are red-eyed bass.
They become a monoculture.
Yeah, they completely take over the system.
Right. So leaving room for biodiversity is like necessary for a healthy reconciliation or a balance.
Sure. Part of the problem with California is that it's a from an aquatic perspective, a very low diversity state. You know, you have 130 or so kinds of fish in the state, and most of them endemic to California, but this is a huge state. And that 130 kinds include subspecies and so forth. It's only about 60 to 70 real full species I found in the state. You go to the north, really? Southeast of the U.S., you'll find in an equivalent area, you'd find 300 or 400 species.
Really?
Or two, that's a slight exaggeration, 100, 200 species. But there's a whole suite of small fishes that occur there that don't occur here. But this is in contrast to the Pacific Ocean. You know, the ocean is incredibly diverse here in California. We've got 400 species of fish known from the saltwater.
Yeah.
Just the opposite of the freshwater systems.
Yeah, that is really interesting. Now, do you think the low diversity of California's freshwater ecosystems is like a recent development, or do you think it's historically been that way?
Well, it's a development. It was low diversity to begin with because the Sierras cut off the access to the main river systems in the west. And used to the Snake River used to flow into the Klamath, which flowed into the Sacramento. Anyway, these rivers resulted in this very isolated, California was a very isolated place. Yeah, it had no aquatic connections to other river systems. So the result is whatever was here once the Sierras rose and some of the other mountain ranges rose, what was here was what we had.
Right.
And almost everything developed in its own way into unique species and found only in California.
So do we have a high degree of endemics then in California as well?
Yeah, about 80% of the fish are endemic. If you count, I'm also counting fish that have some of their populations in Oregon, but almost everything's endemic.
Is that 80% of the native fish or 80% including?
It's 80% of the native fish.
Right.
There are about 50 species of non-native fish, and there are about 60 species of native fish.
Interesting.
And you see that there's not much room for the natives in so much of the area, because the non-natives are really adapted for the man-made environments, the reservoirs and so forth.
It's
depressing when you really think about it, but...
Yeah, well, I'm used to that too. I've spent enough time with marine ecosystems.
Sure.
So what do you think we're at risk most of losing in California's mountain rivers now? Like, what's currently under threat if we don't act, and what actions are important to focus on at this time?
Well, you know, there's a lot of these small fish that are that will disappear if we don't set aside air streams and manage for them in part, the sculpins and the roach and the dace. As a matter of fact, one of the things I'm doing right now, one of my retirement emeritus projects, is describing cryptic species of fish in California. For example, the California roach, which is recognized, was recognized as just one species. I published a paper 2 years ago that says it's actually six species. And each one confined to a very, very small area. Right now I'm working on with the riffle sculpin, which is the sculpin you'd have up in the Merced. And the riffle sculpin is actually two species with four subspecies. Then there's a speckled dace, another small minnow that we're just starting to work on. It looks like we just got the data back. This is done with genomics. The data suggests that the speckled dace in California, which has long been called one species, is actually six species. So yeah. It's hidden diversity. That's the other thing. So that's what I'm saying. I think we're going to be losing is now this, because in the case of the speckled dace, it's a classic. There's a dace that's known only from Long Valley Creek in the Owens Valley. Very different. The genomics is very different from all other dace. It's been isolated clearly for thousands of years in this one tiny little streamer and a couple other streams in that area. And it's now gone from all its native streams. The only populations left are some that are in a pond created by the Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Wow.
So that's the sort of thing you can expect to see a lot of.
Yeah, and it's interesting that I love that idea too of that hidden diversity. I think a lot of ecologists now are breaking species into populations, realizing that diversity, that genetic diversity that's even within a single species is important for the species' long-term survival, so that it can have traits to adapt to change, especially in a rapidly changing environment.
Yeah. Well, that's what the National Marine Fisheries Service, of course, has been ahead of the game on that, where they're declaring evolutionary significant units for a lot of these salmon. And a lot of the endemic salmon in California are ESUs, these evolutionary significant units, which are simply populations that are genetically different enough and isolated enough from other populations. And if you manage them right, they'll maintain their identity. And the problem with that, people thought, there's a lot of politicians who don't think an ESU is a strong enough argument for saving a species. So I'm trying to get things, do the kind of analyses that result in giving enough to go on that I can actually describe this, give the species a scientific name. That immensely increases its protectability under the Endangered Species Act.
Yeah. Though even a full species level extinction sometimes, in the case of the
smelt's a classic example, that's likely to be gone in the next year or two.
And that's due entirely to agricultural pressure, or also invasive species, you said?
It's due to all of the above. You know, everything you can think of that can affect the fish. It's a clam that's eating its food supply. It's very susceptible to pesticides. It's having a hard time. Water's getting too warm for it, so it's having a hard time surviving.
Yeah.
Its spawning areas are pretty much gone. So there's a whole bunch of things that have happened all at once. They came to a head in the 1990s. That's when I filed the petition to list it. But that's just an example of a fish. You can get it listed, and it still goes extinct.
Yeah.
Because to really save the smelt, you'd have to get a lot more water down the Sacramento River.
There's too much pressure.
Wasted out the sea.
Yeah. There's a lot of controversy online directed at you, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And I think part of the problem is it's easy, even though I think everyone should recognize the importance or the significance of any extinction event. The reality is that, you know, for these species that are not as charismatic, it's more difficult to convince people to care about their extinction.
That's right.
But in the case of the smelt, I think, you know, what's really important is that it's an indicator of an ecosystem in decline, and it's just unfortunate that the legal tools that we have don't really leverage that yet.
That's right. Well, and in fact, it's been in such bad shape for so long that it's no longer an indicator of much of anything. It'll disappear, and it'll make no difference to the system.
Right, because it's effectively extinct already. Like it has.
Yeah, right. From an ecological point of view, it's really gone.
Right. Right. Well, who knows? Maybe in a few decades we'll find that nature does find a way, and there will be some small population hidden away in a nook that we didn't even see.
We're hoping that some of these reservoirs that where water's taken out of the delta and winds up in a reservoir in Southern California will have some delta smelt populations.
They'll have readapted their new.
We've actually been pushing people to try sampling those reservoirs.
Really?
And we might get the smelt. Yeah, Pyramid Reservoir and so forth down in Southern California. It'd be amazing if you find them.
Yeah. Well, I didn't even get through all of my questions, but my class has already started, so I better go. But I want to thank you so much for taking this time to talk with me. It's been a real pleasure to get.
Yeah, it's fun to obviously talk about these things. Yeah, let me know if you want to do this again or have some more specific questions you want to talk about. Because actually, if you start asking really general stuff like we did today, I can ramble on forever, which is probably not very useful to you.
No, it's actually very enlightening to me. I think it's really important, especially coming in, you know, as a new student of ecology, to have that broad perspective. So again, I really appreciate your time. I will follow up over email, and I'll send you a copy of this, whatever format I decide upon, I'll send you a copy of it before I post it live. And I'll send you a picture of those bass, and we'll figure out which
they are. I know we got some red-eye bass on the Stanislaus, for example, a few years ago, and so everybody's surprised. So they may be there in the Merced too.
Well, we'll find out. Okay, well, it's been a real pleasure, and I look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Oh, sounds good. Talk to you later.
Bye.